You know, I guess Chuck Colson would know. He, of course, is the founder of Prison Fellowship. I'm looking at his picture here. After sitting at a round table with the president this summer, talking about this, the importance of faith-based programs, especially in the U.S. prison system, what is the status of religions and the progression of religions in the U.S. prison system? We're going to talk about that here in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Dr. James Patrick Holding will be our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. Now, a little bit later in this hour, Karen Temelty of Time Magazine is going to join us. She's written, co-authored the latest in the latest issue of Time Magazine, a story called What Does Bush Owe the Religious Right? We're going to be talking to her about that very subject, getting her reaction to the State of the Union as well. During that, this will be in about 25 minutes here on Issues, Etc. And then we're going to open up the lines for your questions and your comments. During that hour or so of open lines, your reaction to the President's State of the Union last night, first. We're going to have some audio from the State of the Union, also some audio from the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C. Have you ever been to one of these community prayer breakfasts? And if so, how Christian are they? I know that they're quite religious, all very religious, but how Christian are they? I'd like your answer to that question during open lines as well. And then, since the Pope is ailing but apparently on the mend, the question does come up again. What do you expect from the next Pope? He can't last forever, you know, but he has lasted 27 years. What do you expect from the next Pope? Hear from both our Roman Catholic and our non-Catholic listeners during open lines, Issues, Etc. Coming up here in about 40 minutes on Issues, Etc. After Karen Temelty and our open lines, we'll spend the last hour of Issues, Etc. today. Beethoven's Mass in C. We're going to be hearing from Dr. Robert Barrett here in Studio A of the American Conterai about this famous Mass from a famous man. Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February is the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Joshua. Now, this is a compendious volume. It is a thorough commentary, critically written. That is, it is written at a level that is not only applicable to, say, the parish pastor or the scholar, but also the layperson as well. The Concordia Commentary on Joshua is a Christ-centered, cross-focused reading of this Old Testament book and of these events in Old Testament history. The book is $40.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday. In fact, today, you get the better part of 2 hours to make that phone call. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or go to our website and browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. James Patrick Holding is our first guest. He is director of Tecton Apologetics Ministries and author of a story in the latest Christian research journal titled Faith Behind the Fence. JP, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. Glad to be aboard.
Well, how would you, in a nutshell, characterize the state of faith in U.S. penitentiaries and prisons?
Well, I would state that the state of faith in prisons these days is fairly uniform in terms of what inmates are adhering to. We have basically two large groups, Christianity and Islam and their variations. And other groups really don't have much of an effect in prisons these days, so that their effect is minimal and in some cases invisible, depending on what state you go to.
Is prison, by and large, a place of conversion, of proselytization on the part of either Christianity or Islam?
In the case of those two faiths, very much so, yes. And those are very leading evangelizing religions in our prisons today. Others don't have any kind of impact, but those two definitely are having an impact.
Do you have any idea that you can give us of the percentage of prison population that presents itself as religious without respect to, of course, a profession of faith? How much of the prison population does profess some religion?
I should begin by mentioning that getting statistics about religious faith in prison was a very difficult exercise. I consulted a wide number of states. There's no uniform source for nationwide statistics on inmate religious preferences, and many states are variable in their approaches. Some don't classify certain religions. Others haven't done studies in such a long time. But as a rule, I think it's safe to say that the demographics, as far as people who believe anything at all other than atheism, shall we say, are fairly well the same as they are on the outside, which would be like something 95 to 99% of inmates have some religious preference of some sort.
And is religion, generally speaking, since this is a very regulated society, the U.S. prison system, is it given free rein in most of our prisons and penitentiaries?
It is very much given free rein within the confines of rules and regulations. To use the example that I gave in the article, there was an inmate who wanted to be a Satanist, and he demanded to have dove's blood and tarot cards. And there was no way that anyone was going to allow that sort of material into a prison because it could have other uses that were dangerous. On the other hand, in the past I've noted when I've worked in the prison system in my own state that prison chaplains will do what they can to accommodate inmate sensibilities. As, for example, Native American religions will require the inmates to have a sacred plot of ground, and they will set aside a small area within the prison compound that they can use as their sacred ground. So they will do what they can within the rules and regulations. Other things will be allowed as they can be.
I do want to talk a bit about kind of the absence of cults and of a couple other minor religious groups in the prison population in a few minutes. But let's talk about the big two that you mentioned before, Christianity and Islam. How does it break down?
Well, it varies, of course, again by state. For Christianity, I found variations from South Carolina having 9/10 of inmates declaring for some form of Christianity, which is not to say they are dedicated believers per se, but simply as in the military, when asked what they were, they wrote down some Christian denomination for whatever purpose, whereas in Illinois, 2/3 of inmates professed for Christianity. In terms of Islam, again, we have some variability. Here in my home state of Florida, we had around 4% of the population being Islamic. In New York, that was around 14%, in Illinois, 6.5%. So the numbers vary somewhat widely, but I think there's still a general trend there where Christianity is by far the majority of professions, and Islam comes in second.
Can we break Islam down into what we would call, traditional Islam, and then one of its offshoots, the Nation of Islam?
Well, we certainly can statistically. Of course, complicating that is that some states don't recognize some of the breakdowns. Colorado was the state I sampled that didn't recognize the Nation of Islam, for example. And then even if you have the breakdowns, you have the matter of what is it that they sincerely adhere to. One of the things I noted was that inmates may actually be Nation of Islam but profess for mainstream Islam because they're afraid, well, there's a guy from the Nation of Islam, better watch out for him, and they may be more subject to property searches or interference by staff. On the other hand, you may hear some inmate who says all kinds of things that sound like Nation of Islam, but if you talk to him in person, you'll find that he disagrees with many of their core ideas, such as the inferiority of the Caucasian race. And so there's a lot of complexity involved in that in determining exactly what these people are associated with, and I encountered that myself when I worked in a prison setting.
So what is the appeal of Islam, even though it is small by percentage in comparison to Christianity, the prison population? Why does it have its appeal there?
Well, for many inmates, including the ones that I met while I worked in the prison system here, the appeal was that Islam offers an alternative to what is classically called the white man's religion. The majority of people, inmates who converted to Islam while in prison, were African Americans, and they found dissatisfaction with mainstream Christianity and the treatment that they received at the hands of the, quote, white establishment. And I had conversations with many like this, many inmates who were converted to Islam because of this, and they explained their motives plainly. I do not find satisfaction in Christianity, and I think this is an alternative that assists me in asserting my identity.
Is the Nation of Islam in any sense targeting, in the best sense of the word, but targeting as prospects for proselytization, the prison population?
Well, they certainly do not have any kind of formal mechanisms such as prison ministries, shall we say, such as Kairos or Champions for Life. They don't have open evangelistic techniques. They do have, you might say that their best evangelizers are the inmates themselves who convert. I think most of the ideas they get to change come from literature that is brought into the prison, and which is quite allowable, things such as by Malcolm X or Martin Luther King or by even Louis Farrakhan, although I very rarely saw that kind of literature.
I guess the mere mention of Islam does raise the question, in the prison population especially, of whether or not any terrorist organizations might be doing surreptitious recruitment through the prison population.
Absolutely. And that was a concern of Charles Colson recently, and he's voiced his concerns about Al-Qaeda having training manuals that say, go to American prisoners because they might be disenchanted with the way they're being treated and they might be easy to recruit. On the other hand, they are still criminals, which makes them somewhat unreliable even for someone like Al-Qaeda to recruit. And while there's a lot of discussion back and forth among officials about just how much effect there is, we can't argue with the specifics of people like Richard Reed, the famous shoe bomber, who was converted to Islam while in prison. And another example that Colson gave was a fellow named Jose Padilla, who, as it happens, I met him when I worked in prison here in Florida. And he was recruited supposedly to become an operative for Al-Qaeda. And he was captured in Chicago before he could do any damage. The significant thing is, you can say, well, these are only one or two people. Well, it takes only one or two people to put a bomb on a plane. And so I think it is something we should be seriously concerned about, and as even opponents have admitted.
James Patrick Holding is our guest. We're talking about religious trends in U.S. prisons. He's director of Tecton Apologetics Ministries and author of a story in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Faith Behind the Fence. If you have a question or comment for J.P., on religious trends in prisons, feel free to give us a call, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We've kind of covered briefly there the complexion of Islam in the prison population. How would you characterize the complexion of Christianity in the prison population?
A key problem here is, as I noted earlier, these inmates can profess for a certain denomination of Christianity, but that doesn't mean they have any sincere belief or anything more than a nominal deism or theism. In many cases, an inmate will sign up for a particular denomination simply in order to be able to go to church services, and I will put it frankly, because the chapel has air conditioning or heating, and so it's a comfortable place to be. It also makes things easier for them when they want to, like if they have some religious problem and they need to call family in or they want to call a counselor in, they say, well, you're part of this denomination, we'll call in a pastor from this denomination. Alternatively, it does give them a chance to meet with their family in church on Sunday during visiting hours. And it simply gives them something to attach to. But I would say that many of these inmates wouldn't know your basic Christian doctrines one from the other.
Tell us about the organizations that are most often associated with Christianity in the prison population. We've already mentioned here Prison Fellowship. Tell us about that and any others.
Well, Prison Fellowship, of course, was started by Chuck Colson, who was Watergate-involved prosecutor. I was only 5 years old, so I don't know all the details on that. Nevertheless, Chuck Colson is the head of that group, and I'd say that's the largest and most having the most impact. And he seeks to do a ministry within the prison setting and also advocates for certain reforms of the penal system. A couple of others that I've noted, Champions for Life is a prison ministry. That's more of a, I'd say it's more of a popular ministry, a more direct evangelization, less social aspects to their mission. And then we have Kairos, which conducts sort of like mini evangelistic services, usually over weekends, and they will usually have a large number of civilian people who they will recruit to go into the churches within the prisons, and they'll invite a bunch of inmates in, and they'll preach to them and give them food and make them comfortable, and hopefully get some of them to come to the truth, and that has happened. And another group I did not mention in the article that I've seen around, I believe Champions for Life may do this as well, is an independent group of motorcyclists who like to bring their motorcycles in for the inmates to look at. And while they're looking at the motorcycles and talking about them, they'll give them the gospel. There's a lot of creative energy in some of these groups.
Now, this is anecdotal, but we get a number of letters from prisoners who listen to our Sunday night nationally syndicated edition of Issues, etc. And one of the common themes that we hear from these inmates is that the word faith or the word of faith movement is very popular in U.S. prisons. What do you know about this, J.P.?
All I can tell you is that I certainly never saw any of it in Florida when I worked in the system. And Florida, of course, has one of the largest prison systems in the country. I wouldn't be surprised if some aspects of it were very popular in prisons, however, because within the negative setting of a prison, some kind of positive thinking attitude can be attractive to certain people. And I would say that's where the word faith movement might fit in. On the other hand, you might say that this would exemplify why the word faith movement doesn't really work, because I would assume that many of these inmates involved in it are wishing for things that they're not getting while in there.
Mm, yeah, it's kind of a hard place for that to take root, I would imagine.
Yeah.
What is the nature of the service that's permitted for the prison population when it comes to their religions, be they Islam or Christian or something else? Is this self-directed? Are there chaplains assigned? to the general prison population to take care of these needs?
Yes, there are chaplains assigned of some sort, and usually they will come from a Christian background, although there have been some Islamic people who have been in that position. But they will usually be of a Christian orientation, and they will be required to provide some kind of service for all faiths. And sometimes that's accomplished by having someone else come in, whether a rabbi or an imam, to do whatever services are necessary, or ordering literature, or providing whatever is needed within the boundaries of the rules. And it's a very stressful job, a very hard one to do. I've met many prison chaplains, and that's something I would find very difficult to do because it often requires you, in a sense, to compromise what you're doing. You're not really allowed, for example, a Christian chaplain could not witness to an Islamic inmate. He's not allowed to do that unless perhaps they bring it up first.
What about this, and I found this fascinating because I would have thought differently, the almost complete absence of cults.
Yes.
From the prison population.
Yes, I have to admit I was a little surprised about that, too. Now, just starting in Florida, for example, the statistics here, Jehovah's Witnesses, 1%, Mormons, 0.13%, Santeria, 0.09%. I checked with all these prison ministries and a few other states, and the results were basically the same. You had a few variations regionally, such as Colorado having more people involved in the Native American religions. But as a whole, there's still not a lot of those represented in there.
Why do you think this is?
From what I can tell, and I can only offer the speculations of people like the head of Kairos Ministry, that first of all, cults are not really interested in evangelizing in the prisons because who wants to evangelize prisoners is their thought. You know, you have criminals as part of your membership, and that just doesn't look good. Aside from that, conducting a ministry within a prison setting, and this is true of mainstream Christianity as well, is simply very difficult. And I can tell you, for example, that just to conduct a Kairos mission within a prison in Florida, every member of your group has to go through a thorough background check, and you also have to go through searches. Depending on the level of security, you might even have to go through a full pat-down, not to the point of strip searching, but certainly it's something that can be humiliating or troubling for people. And then, of course, just being in the prison can be frightening in and of itself, simply because, well, you're surrounded by criminals.
Now, you do mention that Scientology has, if not made inroads into the prison population, they have not been shy about sending their literature unsolicited into the population.
Not at all. That amuses me particularly because I was a librarian in a prison setting, and I always got the big boxes of books from Scientology. They didn't send it to the chapel, I think because chaplains were throwing it away more often than librarians were. But every year at least, I would get a huge box of books from them. And I had no space for them. I basically threw them away or just had fun with them somehow. There's no interest by inmates in any of this. I mean, they don't have any interest in Scientology whatsoever.
Apparently, that just appeals to the Hollywood, or more to the well-heeled Hollywood types, I guess.
I would say so.
What about any influence or presence of Eastern religions or Eastern-influenced spiritualities in the prison population?
In terms of actual people professing to be Hindus or Buddhists, the number is minimal, as it is with the cults, and no more reflective of the number than would be in the U.S. population. Where we do have some inroads being made is with transcendental meditation, which is being brought in, as it is in many places, under the guise of something non-religious that's being used to relieve stress or what have you, or reduce recidivism. I noted there was a study done at Folsom State Prison in California some years ago claiming that recidivism, that is, people not returning to crime after they're released, was helped by TM. Now, I don't know whether any more studies have been done on that, but in a trade magazine for corrections industry called Corrections Today, they talked about TM and referred to it as, quote, a powerful cure for crowding and high recidivism in U.S. prisons. But they had no hint or knowledge that it was derived from Eastern religious roots. And the same thing also is being done with yoga. It's being brought in sometimes as advertised as a completely secular alternative that brings relaxation and loss of stress. But again, no connection is made to any of its religious roots.
So the prisoners may be doing TM. They may be doing very formal forms of yoga, completely unaware that they are engaging in inherently religious practices.
Oh, absolutely. That's absolutely the case. On the positive side, as far as we're concerned, the odds are that one of these guys picks up a mat and goes to meditate, he's not going to be very popular among his peers. So that somewhat hinders the spread of practices like TM and yoga behind bars.
Do we need a better accounting of the religious affiliations or preferences of the prison population? And if so, why, JP?
Well, I would say absolutely we do need one, and that is evidenced by the fact that, as I noted, all the states have variable categories. Some states have not done a study in a long time, and all the numbers, whatever we have out there, are not unified. In terms of why we need this, I think we need to keep track of this because the fact is that the majority of inmates, though they are in prison now, will eventually be back out here with us. And what they believe in there will eventually come to affect what they do out here. And that's shown at the most radical case with Richard Reed converting to Islam and taking the action he did on that flight.
Have any studies been done, to your knowledge, trying to see if there's a connection between religious devotion in prison and a recidivism rate or ability to kind of break the cycle of crime outside of prison?
I believe some studies have been done by Prison Fellowship in particular showing that their programs have assisted in recidivism. I didn't access any of those for my report, but I have seen and heard about such things being done, yes.
Tectonics.org is the website for our guest, James Patrick Holding, and Tectonics Apologetics Ministries. Let me spell it out for you. It's TEKTONICS.org. TEKTONICS.org. What does Tectonics stand for, JP?
Well, it comes from the Greek word for carpenter, the profession of Jesus on earth, tekton, T-E-K-T-O-N. And with that, I came with the phrase building blocks for Christian faith. I had to add the ICS because tekton.org was taken by someone else at the time.
Oh. James Patrick Holding is director of Tekton Apologetics Ministries and author of this story in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Faith Behind the Fence. JP, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks very much for having me, Todd.
When we come back from this break, Karen Tunnelty, a conversation with her. She has co-authored this story in Time magazine. Yesterday we were talking about the story of the 25 most influential evangelicals that was written by David Van Bima. We spoke with him yesterday. When we come back, we'll talk with Karen. Now, she has co-written this article on whether or not George W. Bush owes the religious right anything, and if so, what does he owe them? George W. Bush is the president most associated with the religious right. And one of the first things I ask Karen is this on purpose? Is this a purposeful, intentional association? We'll get the answer to that question. And when we're done with Karen, I'd like your reaction to several things. First of all, we'll be hearing some audio from last night's State of the Union address. I would like your reaction to the president's speech. Also, do you think that the president owes the religious right anything? In particular, does the president owe Christians something? And if so, what? So we start out another term, another 4 years ahead for George W. Bush. The consensus seems to be, yes, he owes Christians something. What would that be? And let's put it this way. If we get to the end of these 4 years, what will the president have to have gone to the mat for to satisfy you? If there's an issue, you say, if he doesn't deal with this or at least try to deal with this in the next 4 years, I will be disappointed. He owes me this. As a voter who helped get him elected, what is that issue going to be? It's open lines when our conversation with Karen Tumulty concludes, and I'd like your answers to those questions, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In addition to some audio from the president's speech last night, we'll also hear a little bit of audio regarding the National Prayer Breakfast. I'm curious about these because I've never been to a prayer breakfast. Well, I've eaten breakfast and prayed, but I've never been to one of these events. Community, sometimes interfaith, sometimes interreligious events, like a mayor's prayer breakfast. I've never been to one of these, and I'm curious. How Christian are they? I mean, explicitly Christian. I know, oh, there are lots of Christians there, and so-and-so is a Christian, and maybe someone mentioned Jesus. My question is, how explicitly Christian? Or are these kind of the generic American civil religion? God gets mentioned. Jesus might be tossed in there occasionally by a few. But for that matter, it could just be any religion gathering to meet. We'll talk about it after our conversation with Karen Tumulty, which is next.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Joshua is one of the towering figures of the Old Testament, a successor to the prophet Moses, the first of the judges. He leads God's people into and through the promised land. But as great as Joshua is in the Old Testament, does he serve to prefigure someone even greater? Is there a connection between Joshua in the Old Testament and our Savior Jesus Christ in the New? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Joshua, is a Christ-centered and cross-focused reading of this Old Testament book. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find information there on the Concordia Commentary on Joshua, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February. Or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040.
It's rare that you see a church building in North Africa. However, this Global Minute lets you hear that churches do exist there, and many more are starting up quickly. A small number of people across the countries of North Africa are followers of Jesus Christ. They can't build church buildings, but they can meet quietly and even secretly in homes. If authorities in some countries discovered that they were Christians meeting as a church, they could be fired from their jobs, have their names kept in a police file, or even jailed. But despite these barriers, the mission agency Avant reports that the time frame to begin a church has been reduced significantly. Avant is a well-respected mission agency using media to assist church leaders in North Africa. Pray for Christ's message to change hearts throughout the countries of North Africa. Avant's website can clue you in on gospel breakthroughs. Log on to avmi.org, avmi.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. No one lives anymore in SNAG.
Now hear about people
territory.
Who grew up learning that
not
the best
not many people
way-
ever did. SNAG being, as people say, a God-forsaken place. Since travel in the Yukon is often by plane, SNAG's few people and airstrip were a rare place where planes in trouble could land. That was often the difference between life and death. On this date, February 3rd, 1947, the coldest temperature ever recorded in North America was recorded in SNAG, 81 degrees below zero. Today, SNAG is deserted. Inhabitants who are still alive live somewhere else, someplace warmer. Robert Service wrote The Law of the Yukon. This is the law of the Yukon, that only the strong shall thrive, that surely the weak shall perish, and only the fit survive. Dissolute, damned, and despairful, crippled and palsied and slain, this is the will of the Yukon. Lo, how she makes it plain. In ways literal, but more often figurative, we all experience the cold realities of life, times we feel God-forsaken. We aren't, the Bible says. In fact, the Spirit is very present, trying to kindle in us a greater desire to expect something better, to detach our heart from our problems, to leave our snags behind, longing for a better country, a heavenly one.
Issues, Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois. Christ Our Savior is located at 612 North State Street in Freeburg. The Reverend Bruce Kaseman is the pastor. Their phone number, area code 618-539-5664. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, and Issues Etc. underwriter on AM 850 KFUO. I'm Todd Wilkin. Karen Tumulty joins us. She is a national political correspondent for Time Magazine. She's co-authored a story in the latest issue of Time Magazine. We talked about one of those stories yesterday. This one, What Does Bush Owe the Religious Right? Karen, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you, Todd.
Before we talk about George W. Bush and the religious right, what did you make of the State of the Union speech last night?
Well, I think it was a fairly well-received speech. In fact, I cannot recall another moment in a State of the Union speech as dramatic as the moment near the end where we saw up in the gallery the mother of the slain Marine embracing the, you know, daughter of the assassinated Iraqi leader. And the general results from the speech, particularly, you know, the domestic issues that Bush rolled out, have been pretty positive.
And what stood out for you beyond the kind of the theater aspect of the speech? What stood out from the content of the president's speech with you?
Well, one thing that does strike me is that when it comes to Social Security, which of course was the biggest element of the speech, the biggest and hardest questions really aren't addressed. The president made it very, very clear that he is willing to consider all sorts of options, things that would have been considered heresy even among Republicans in the past. But he's not yet behind any option on two of the thorniest questions, you know, one of which is how he actually makes the system any safer than it was, how he goes about fixing this funding imbalance. And the second question is how he pays for his personal savings accounts.
President Bush is probably the president most associated with the religious right. From the perspective of the White House, is this on purpose? Do they cultivate this perception?
Well, I think it's yes and no, because the president is a, you know, person of very deep religious faith, and he is, you know, probably the most openly devout president we've seen, at least since Jimmy Carter. So this really and truly is a part of who George Bush is, the way he talks about faith and the way his faith influences both his style and the substance of his governing. But on the other hand, the, you know, religious coalition, conservative Christians, are also very much a part of the political strategy of this White House, and were a very important part of President Bush's November reelection victory.
Do you think that this is a mutual understanding between President Bush and the main figures of the religious right, that this is one hand does wash the other, and if there's political cachet to be had from this, that's fine with the religious right too?
Well, you know, it has definitely been the understanding up to this point. But now I think we've reached a moment of real tension in the relationship between the president and his most, you know, ardent backers. And that is that now that President Bush has been reelected, you know, religious conservatives are expecting him to go forward on some of the promises that he made to them. And they were very, very concerned, for instance, on the question of the anti-gay marriage constitutional amendment, something that the president talked about during his presidential campaign, an issue that they say really motivated a lot of their base to get to the polls. And then the president, in the week before he was inaugurated, in an interview with the Washington Post, seemed to suggest that he wasn't going to push very hard with the United States Senate to get this amendment ratified. And then, of course, it wasn't mentioned at all in his inaugural address. So there has been, you know, some tension that once again last night, and I think in part because of the complaints by conservative religious leaders, that it did show up again in the State of the Union speech. But there is a real question now how hard he is going to push on some of the issues that really matter a lot to them. And the biggest one, of course, is going to be judicial nominations.
Well, here's the quote in your story from Dr. James Dobson of Focus on the Family. At the very top of the list is the judiciary, which we feel is out of control and threatening to religious liberty and the institution of the family. That would be the most important thing to us, because every other issue that we care about is linked one way or another to the courts. So what do you see the president doing with regard to the courts if, in fact, this is the first thing that they think the president owes them?
Well, one of the first things he did was to resubmit the judicial nominations that the Senate wouldn't act on last time. So that suggests he is going to take a fairly hard line. Most people looking at Chief Justice Rehnquist's poor health believe that if, in fact, his is the first vacancy on the court, that is not going to be quite a tricky situation, just because Justice Rehnquist is a conservative. He would probably be replaced with a conservative. But the real fight is probably going to come on the Supreme Court vacancy after that, if, in fact, the next one to retire is either a liberal justice or a justice who's been a swing vote on various hot-button social issues.
What about those, if there are any, who, among the leadership of the religious right, who have claimed victory or claimed credit, in fact, for the president's reelection here?
Well, that's interesting because you actually hear it being argued both ways. There was a very sort of inflammatory, congratulatory note written to the president the morning after his reelection from Bob Jones III, the president of Bob Jones University in South Carolina, who essentially said, you know, put your agenda on the front burner and let it boil. You owe the liberals nothing. But then you hear other people like, you know, Chuck Colson, who is now a revered figure in the religious community for his work in evangelizing prisons, who says, wait a minute, you know, every time Christians have reached a point, conservative Christians, of getting political power, they tend to shoot themselves in the foot by overreaching. And his argument is that this is, in fact, a moment for humility, not aggression.
We're talking with Karen Tumulty. She is national political correspondent for Time magazine, co-author of a story in the latest issue of Time titled, What Does Bush Owe the Religious Right? Karen, can any future president afford, at least for the foreseeable future, to ignore the element that now is commonly described as the religious right?
Well, I think that it's going to be difficult. I mean, the pattern, the history of the religious right is that they get very energized and they show up to vote, then they get discouraged, and then they don't show up to vote for a few cycles. But you do see, particularly among Democrats, a real concern lately that they have essentially lost the so-called values debate and that they are somehow going to have to, you know, get back into that. And so you hear a lot of Democrats now agonizing over, you know, how they can demonstrate their own religious beliefs.
Do you think they can do this?
Well, you know, it's, you look at somebody, you know, as recently as Bill Clinton was somebody who was very, you know, comfortable talking the language of faith.
And can we expect then, say, 2 years from now when the next presidential election cycle begins, for there to be new coalitions, religious coalitions, that are trying to model themselves after what happened with President Bush and the religious right in 2004?
I think so. And again, there is probably no topic at the moment that is more under discussion, you know, within Democratic circles as sort of how they can get themselves back into the values debate.
The one thing that we haven't discussed in any detail here is, of course, the abortion issue. That is tied in to the Supreme Court issue in an indirect way. What markers are due from evangelicals and the religious right with the Bush administration regarding abortion?
Well, of course, the big one they care about more than anything is overturning Roe versus Wade, and that, again, is something that is going to require remaking the Supreme Court. But there are a number of bills coming to the floor of the House and the Senate that have, you know, they essentially play in the subsidiary issues in the abortion debate. For instance, one that would make it a crime for anyone other than a minor's parents to transport the minor across state lines for an abortion. This is to essentially prevent people from evading parental notification laws in various states. Another one would require abortion doctors to inform a patient after a certain point in the pregnancy of the possibility that a fetus could feel pain during an abortion. You know, these are pieces of legislation, I think, that stand a much better chance of passing in this Congress than they did last time.
Okay, finally, Karen, here's my problem. A guy like me gets lumped in because I'm pro-life and I'm opposed to homosexuality and gay marriage. I get lumped in with the likes of Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson or James Dobson. But I don't buy into the whole myth of America as a Christian nation. I am not in favor of prayer in schools. I've got real concerns about what kind of prayers would be prayed. I am not necessarily in favor of posting the Ten Commandments in judicial houses. I don't want to be lumped in with the religious right. I also don't want to be lumped in with what I would think of as the religious left, the John Shelby Spongs, the Robert Funks, the Bill Moyers. Can you come up with a term